talking about The Demon in the Machine with its author, Paul Davies, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. The full title of Paul's new book is The Demon in the Machine: How Hidden Webs of Information Are Solving the Mystery of Life. And even that audacious title doesn't do the book full justice. My conversation with Paul is minutes away. Down the line, we'll close with Bruce Betts' latest look at the crowded night sky in this week's edition of What's Up. Planetary science and missions dominate our review of the latest headlines in the Downlink, the Planetary Society's digest of the biggest stories from around our little universe, are collected each week by editorial director Jason Davis. Alan Stern and the science team behind NASA's New Horizons mission released new results from the spacecraft's flyby of the Kuiper Belt object Arakoth last year. The findings published in the journal Science further support the notion that Arakoth's two round lobes formed in the same region of space and came together in a slow-speed collision. With NASA's 2020 rover now in Florida for its summertime launch, we've learned that the European Space Agency's Rosalind Franklin Mars rover has made it to France, where it will be mated to its descent module. The critical parachutes needed for the mission are still undergoing tests. NASA announced the selection of four mission concepts in its relatively low-cost Discovery program. The only shame is that all four may not be funded. Two aim for Venus, another for Jupiter's violent moon Io, with the last targeting Neptune's Triton. The field should narrow to two later this year. Lastly, your latest opportunity to slip the surly bonds of Earth without having to buy a ticket. NASA is taking applications for the next astronaut class. The window is open from March 2nd through the 31st. Who knows? You might end up on the moon or Mars. You can always find more at planetary.org/downlink. Don't forget that we're about to expand the downlink. Life equals matter plus information. That simple statement is at the core of Paul Davies' wonderful new book, but there is so much more. The origin of life on Earth and elsewhere, whether exotic quantum mechanics is utilized by living things, the staggering complexity of a single cell, and how to look for life elsewhere. Paul is Regents Professor of Physics at Arizona State University. That's also where he heads the Beyond Center for Fundamental Concepts in Science, a fitting role for this latter-day Renaissance man who is a theoretical physicist, a cosmologist, an astrobiologist, and more. The Demon in the Machine is, I believe, his 31st book. I recently sat down with Paul at the University of California, San Diego, where the Arthur C. Clarke Center for Human Imagination allowed us to use its studio. Here are excerpts from our nearly one-hour conversation. You can hear it all at planetary.org/radio. Paul Davies, welcome back to Planetary Radio. It has been a long time since we talked about your book, what, of about 10 years ago, The Eerie Silence. I loved that book. But this book is as awe-inspiring as any nonfiction I have ever read. So thank you for The Demon in the Machine, which was what we'll talk about over the next few minutes.
Well, thank you for being so enthusiastic.
And we will also, if your publisher is agreeable, we'll make a copy available to the winner of this week's Space Trivia Contest that we'll get to in the What's Up segment of the show that will come after this conversation. I want to start really where you finish the book in your epilogue. It's led by a quote from Albert Einstein. One can best feel in dealing with living things how primitive physics still is. Do you believe that understanding life on Earth and possibly elsewhere is going to require a new understanding of physics?
I do. Now, I'm a physicist, and one doesn't say lightly that there is new physics going on in life. But this quest to answer the question, what is life, goes back many, many decades, and most obviously to Erwin Schrödinger, who in 1943 gave a series of lectures, famous lectures, in Dublin, Ireland, which was neutral during World War II. asking the question, what is life? The key thing is, can life be understood by physics? Well, I think every physicist would say, well, of course. But the real question is, can it be understood by known physics, or does it require new physics? Schrödinger was open-minded about it. I've been open-minded about it my entire career, reluctant to suggest new physics. But I have now come to the conclusion that, yes, we need new physics, or we will discover new physics in living systems. So biology is the next frontier of physics.
Because you brought it up, I mean, you mentioned these lectures by Schrödinger at a couple of places in the book. He was quite the visionary with these lectures.
Oh, absolutely. Now, Schrödinger, remember, was a giant of theoretical physics. He was the architect of quantum mechanics, the most successful scientific theory ever. At a stroke, quantum mechanics explained non-living matter all the way from atoms, atomic nuclei, subatomic particles, right up to stars. So enormously successful. But it wouldn't explain living matter, not readily anyway. And so fast forward from the 1920s, which was when Schrödinger and Heisenberg and others put quantum mechanics together, to now the World War II years. And here is Schrödinger, somewhat isolated from the mainstream because he's in neutral Ireland. He didn't join the Allied war effort. He's living there with his wife and his mistress and able to indulge his fancies by turning his attention to this really deep problem about the nature of life. And there was a lot of speculation in the 1930s that, you know, was quantum mechanics going to explain life, or wouldn't it explain life, and what did it take? And he gave these lectures, and it's widely attributed to Schrödinger, what we think of now as the birth of molecular biology. So Crick and Watson, who discovered the structure of DNA, were famously influenced by this book. A lot of other people were. And so it was a very influential book. But then the decades rolled by and everyone was rushing to understand life at the molecular level. And in my view, lost sight of the big picture, that it's life is much more than what's going on at molecular level.
Which is much of what you address in this book. There's a very simple equation, or at least statement, in the book, which is in the biggest typeface in the book, and it is life equals matter plus information. Does that mean that you believe that information is the distinguishing quality of what sets living matter apart from the rest of stuff?
It is, and of course I have to explain that information in this scientific context is not just like when we use it in everyday life, information in a bus timetable or something of that sort. Information as a physical quantity. There's a historical precedent. We use the word energy in daily life, and it's got sort of rough and ready meaning, but physicists define energy in a very precise way, and it enters into the laws of physics. We now know that information, properly defined, enters into the fundamental laws of physics, into the laws of thermodynamics, in fact. And the demon in the title of the book refers to something called Maxwell's demon. Just to take you through the history of this, so in the middle of the 19th century, there was a lot of interest in the nature of heat. And James Clerk Maxwell, then working at King's College in London, made seminal contributions to the theory of heat. And he came up with a curious thought. It was not much more than a musing, which he put in a letter to a friend. And that was, imagine some diminutive being, which came to be called a demon, who could see and follow molecules in their paths and then direct them using a shutter mechanism to one side of a box or another. By doing that, could accumulate the fast-moving molecules one side and the slow-moving molecules the other. And now, because molecular speed is a measure of temperature, the demon would, in effect, have used the information about molecular motion to create a temperature difference, and any competent engineer could then build an engine to run off that temperature difference and do useful work. So it looked like information was a type of fuel. But it seemed paradoxical. It seemed to fly in the face of the cherished second law of thermodynamics, which says basically you can't get something for nothing. It looked like Maxwell had invented a perpetual motion machine. And this lay like an inconvenient truth at the heart of physics for decades and decades. But now, just in the last few years, nanotechnology has advanced to the point where we can make I say we, my experimental colleagues, can actually make Maxwell demons. They can make these little devices which use information about thermal agitation to gain a work advantage. You can only do it on a nanoscale. This isn't going to revolutionize kitchen refrigerators anytime soon. But nevertheless, the principle is established that information is a source of fuel. It enters into the laws of physics. So it has some physical purchase. And that's the point. It's the little chink that opens the way to explaining how information can make a difference when it comes to the amazing things that living organisms do.
More of Paul Davies is just ahead. This is Planetary Radio.
Where did we come from? Are we alone in the cosmos? These are the questions at the core of our existence. And the secrets of the universe are out there, waiting to be discovered. But to find them, we have to go into space. We have to explore. This endeavor unites us. Space exploration truly brings out the best in us, encouraging people from all walks of life to work together to achieve a common goal, to know the cosmos and our place within it. This is why the Planetary Society exists. Our mission is to give you the power to advance space science and exploration. With your support, we sponsor innovative space technologies, inspire curious minds, and advocate for our future in space. We are the Planetary Society. Join us.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan with my guest, physicist, astrobiologist, and author, Paul Davies. Here are more excerpts from my recent conversation with Paul about his latest book, The Demon in the Machine.
One of the many moments in the book that left me speechless was when you talked about these organisms, extremophiles, as we have come to call them, who live near these vents at the bottom of the ocean, that perform photosynthesis, and that they are amazingly efficient, that there are some of these photosynthetic structures that can actually get benefit from a single photon.
Right, right. So it looks like photosynthesis, which, as I've described, and we think of plants, is exploiting these quantum effects. But we have to look at the history of photosynthesis. It didn't start with plants. It started deep down in the deep ocean volcanic vents billions of years ago. And so life probably began in that setting. And there isn't much light down there. In fact, it's there is no light from the sun penetrates to those sorts of depths, talking kilometers. But there will be some infrared radiation from these hot surfaces and so on. Photosynthesis almost certainly first evolved. That is, when I say photosynthesis, I mean using the energy of photons to make biomass, which is what it amounts to. But the mechanism, original mechanism, was probably very different. And of course, we can speculate that it was at that stage that life discovered a quantum advantage in that deep, dark hellhole, as we might think of it now, discovered that quantum mechanics could buy some advantage. And in biology, you don't need much advantage for it to become selected for. And that then once you have the basis of a mechanism, turning photons into biomass in some way, or using it as an energy source for converting chemicals into biomass, once you've got that, then that basic principle can then spread to life on the surface, as you know, clearly it has, without having to rediscover it all over again. So a lot of these things go back a long, long way in time. We can date the genes. We can look at the genes that drive this and get some idea of when these effects evolved. This is a very new field. It's called phylostratigraphy. It means we can take extant genes and ask something about these recently evolved genes, ancient genes. And we always have the impression that anything that is truly fundamental to the way life does business must be very ancient. You build the foundations before you build the rest of the house. And this is a burgeoning field of phylostratigraphy, and it's very important for cancer research as well as things like photosynthesis.
Also an area that you explore in the book. I don't mean to imply that photosynthesis may have been around at the origin of life on Earth, but I do wonder what all of this may say to you about how we should be looking for the origin of life, not just here, but elsewhere.
Of course, we have no certainty that life on Earth began on Earth. It may have begun on Mars, for example, and come to Earth in impact ejecta. We know Earth and Mars trade rocks on a regular basis, and organisms cocooned in those rocks can certainly make the journey and be viable at the other end. So Mars cooled quicker, was ready for life sooner. Mm. So it may have got going there and come here at a later stage. But of course, it doesn't...
That's just exporting the question.
Yes, it doesn't explain how non-life turned into life. We actually don't know the setting. There are a few favorites out there. Some people like the deep ocean volcanic vent setting. Some people prefer ponds on the surface that go through cycles of wet and dry. Some people like droplets in the air. Some people want to take it off the planet and put it in comets. Who knows? We absolutely don't know, because we don't know what the process was. As we were discussing earlier, it might have been the quantum mechanics played a really important role. But we're very far from establishing that. And experiments in the lab, of which this university was a pioneer, blazed a trail of, can you cook up life in the lab by mixing stuff up that we think represents the early Earth and sparking electricity through it to see what will happen.
You're talking about the Miller-Urey
experiment.
The famous Miller-Urey
experiment. Stanley Miller was here. That gives you some simple building blocks. And there's a whole tradition of chemists doing that, of trying to cook up more and more complex molecules. But the gulf between these sorts of building block molecules and the simplest living things, like Craig Venter's Mycoplasma laboratorium, is a slimmed down organism. But it's still immensely complex compared to a few of these building blocks. And that gulf is huge. And as I've been at pains to point out, I think it's focusing on the wrong problem. I think that life, it's not the stuff of which it's made. Mm. It's the software. It's the information processing. And that's where the transition from non-life to life, that's the one we have to understand. How do molecules write code, computer code, to put it bluntly? It's like cells are really just, in many ways, like computers. They store information, they process it, and they propagate it. And it's in code. It's encrypted. The genetic code is an encryption. It's one of countless possible mathematical codes that could be used. All known life uses the same code. How did that code come to exist in the first place? How did these stupid molecules write anything as clever as the genetic code? We don't know. But that's a software problem, not a hardware problem.
We could stop there, but I must take you just a bit deeper into speculation and discuss life as we don't know it. For example, if there is some kind of or some level of quantum mechanical reliance by life, and if quantum mechanical processes don't like heat, don't like the chaos that heat brings, what about someplace like Titan, the moon of Saturn, or even colder places, Pluto, which may have liquid water someplace, but is a very cold environment? I ignore liquid water, because I did say life that is not like us. Does this get your mind working at all?
Probably the craziest paper I ever published, which was in the journal Nature about 15 years ago, was on a quantum origin of life. And I wanted to go even colder, so I picked an interstellar grain that might be rather close to the temperature of the cosmic microwave background, about 3 degrees above absolute zero. If you want to go cold, that's a pretty good place to do it. And conjectured, by analogy with a computer again, when you think about a computer, the microchip is incredibly fast at processing information. It really turns over at an enormous speed. But you turn off the power and you lose that information. So what do computers do? Well, they store it on, used to be a hard drive, used to be literally a spinning disk. So let's go with that analogy. Big, clunky, slow, but very robust. The information is stored there. So I had this idea that quantum life, if it could be based on quantum replication, variation, and selection, would be some condensed matter physics system like a spin glass with complexity there, but a replicative ability as well. I've no idea about the physics of that. You know, it all sounds impressive. I didn't work it out. But, you know, imagine something that was incredibly fast because it was essentially quantum mechanical information mm-hmm. processing, qubits, not rather than bits, to use the jargon. But hopelessly delicate and unable to spread. But imagine that it backed up that information in the equivalent of a hard disk. And what that hard disk would be is organic molecules, big, clunky, slow, but robust things. Mm. And then eventually it's as if, you know, the hard disk says to the chip in a computer, I've got enough to make a living on my own, goodbye, and goes off and inherits the Earth. And so... That was the scenario, that the organic backup, slow but reliable, would be the next generation of life. These little grains are probably still doing their thing out there, but we wouldn't know about them because they couldn't live on Earth because it's too warm.
Seeding the universe.
Yes. This is a crazy theory.
but great fun.
Well, my feeling is that this is such a problem, this origin of life, that we need to just think outside the box. We need new concepts. So it's not enough to just think, well, we've got a rough idea. You got this molecule or that molecule, and will it make more of this? And is it more efficient at making that? Well, that's locked into a particular way of thinking, which, fine, you know, if people want to do that. But I think I'm sort of bored with that narrative. We just need to think, if life is really about software, not hardware, not the stuff, it's about the information patterns. Well, as you know, again, with a computer, you can copy a file from a computer onto a flash drive, and then you can send it down optical fiber and so on. The medium, the instantiation of that information is irrelevant. The pattern is it transcends that. And if you think of life as really being about copying patterns of information and not so much about copying the stuff, then we don't need all this complicated replicative machinery. So in life as we know it, you copy the molecules, you make new molecules. You make that, it's like, you know, you want to copy a file from your computer, you put it on a flash drive. You wouldn't think, well, let's make another hard drive with everything on it. I mean, it would just not be the way to do it. So I think trying to think in those terms or any other terms, we just need new thinking about this extraordinary thing that we call life.
My strong impression is that you enjoy thinking about these things, topics like this, even more than the great enjoyment I've gotten out of this conversation or your book.
It's true that I enjoy it, and I wouldn't write about it if I didn't think it was enormous fun.
Thank you, Paul. This has been delightful.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
The book is The Demon in the Machine, How Hidden Webs of Information Are Solving the Mysteries of Life, by our guest, Paul Davies. It is from the University of Chicago Press, and I could not recommend it more highly. Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. Bruce Betts is the chief scientist of the Planetary Society. He is back to tell us about the night sky, and we'll do some other stuff, like in the new contest, give away that copy of Paul Davies' book, The Demon in the Machine.
Planet party time again. The evening in the west, Venus dominating, looking like a super bright star. And then on the 27th of February, the moon, the very crescenty moon, will join Venus in the evening west. And then in the pre-dawn east, we've got Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Got Mars to the upper right, looking reddish. Jupiter much brighter to the lower left. And then if you have a clear view to the horizon, you can pick up Saturn down below. We move on to This Week in Space History. It was 1965 that Ranger 8 impacted the moon on purpose, taking pictures and transmitting them back before it did that. We'll come back to Ranger. And then 1994, the Clementine spacecraft entered lunar orbit.
I don't want to ruin any trivia questions, but was that the first Ranger to be successful? I know that there were a whole bunch that weren't.
Gosh, funny you'd ask. That makes this less of a random space fact. The Ranger program was a bunch of robotic spacecraft that were designed to get the highest resolution at the time pictures of the lunar surface as they were planning for landing humans. And they were impactors, so they would just take pictures and transmit as they were headed down to crash. And indeed, the first six failed. According to the internet, the program was called Shootin' Hope for a while. That's embarrassing. And then something changed, and JPL succeeded with Ranger 7, which successfully returned images in July 1964. And then there were a couple more successful missions as well, and they gave us close-up views of the moon as they slammed in, or before they slammed into the moon.
I was a very young kid, and I remember watching the live coverage. Since the pictures had to come back live, I mean, you know, wasn't going to be able to transmit them later, it was absolutely fascinating, and it was such a big deal at the time. I still remember it with a lot of excitement.
Cool. Well, then you will enjoy our trivia contest as well. But first, let's talk about the previous trivia contest, which is always interesting. I'm sure lots of people had it on the tip of their tongue when I asked, what was Lyman Spitzer's middle name, for whom the Spitzer Space Telescope was named? How'd we do, Matt?
Here's the answer. In the form of our submission from the poet laureate Dave Fairchild in Kansas, who also mentioned what a guy Spitzer was. I'll have more about that. Maybe you will too. He graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Yale. Lyman Spitzer Sr. had a son who shared his name, born in 1914, who would rise to great acclaim. Telescopes and asteroids his moniker would share, although you'll rarely see the strong part mentioned anywhere.
Indeed, strong. Lyman Strong Spitzer Jr.
Then congratulations go to first-time winner, longtime listener, Joel Lecter in Quebec. You have won yourself a copy of Spitzer Project scientist Michael Werner's new book, More Things in the Heavens, How Infrared Astronomy is Expanding Our View of the Universe, and a Planetary Radio t-shirt.
Yay!
Now we're ready to go on to your what, ranger-related new question?
Ranger-related new question. What ranger mission imaged Mare Tranquillidadis, or the Sea of Tranquility, the place that, of course, later would be the first place humans stepped onto Mars, or the moon, take your pick. What ranger mission imaged Mare Tranquillidadis, or however you pronounce it? I'm sorry to all the Latins in the crowd. Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
Got till the 26th. That's February 26th at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us this one. And if you win, you will get a copy of Paul Davies' The Demon in the Machine, How Hidden Webs of Information Are Solving the Mystery of Life. And a Planetary Society rubber. I didn't do that very well. Rubber asteroid.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, think about your favorite word that begins with the letter X. Shouldn't take long, although if you go to other languages, maybe. Thank you. Good night.
If I had a xylophone, I would use it like the old NBC tones. Da, da, da. I would have a series of tones like that for planetary radio. So I'm going to say xylophone.
Cool. We should get you a xylophone.
It only needs three. It only needs three notes.
It'll be cheaper that way.
He's Bruce Betts, the chief scientist of the Planetary Society. He joins us every week for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its well-informed members. Mark Hilverde is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. Ad Astra.